We are doing a two-part series. It was presented by one of the professors at our seminary, Puritan Reform Theological Seminary, Dr. David Murray. And it's a presentation on a godly use of technology. The first part, which you missed last week, was just showing four basic biblical principles that ought to guide our understanding of and use of technology. If I can rely on my rather shaky memory, one of the principles is all technology is God's technology, in the sense that there's nothing really new under the sun, that God created everything from which everything is rearranged and so-called invented, and that technology is not inherently evil, but is applied either in good or evil ways. And as well, talking about the need, to respond, to use technology in godliness. And what he's going to do today is apply seven steps of a program. He's suggesting a seven-step approach to how to train both parents and children and grandchildren in our cases, as far as the proper use of technology. So Dr. David Murray will carry it from here. Let's ask the Lord's blessing on what we're doing first.
To show you how this really works in practice, I'd like to now apply this seven-step training program to social networking and to Facebook specifically. But how big is social networking?
In making the case about how large an impact social networking has, the whole next section of the presentation was just a vast number of statistics that illustrate how widespread and pervasive the practice is. But since it was all just visual and there was no audio, we've excerpted that section of the presentation and just picked up where Dr. Murray continued to speak.
How big is social networking? Well, obviously it's huge. And like technology in general, social networking, Facebook, has many good uses. It encourages communication and helps keep families current with one another's news. It can be a useful and inexpensive marketing and promotion tool for a small business. There are educational uses. And of course, it allows us to share the gospel with others. I'm sure some have even come to faith through Facebook interactions. But of course, like all digital technology, Facebook has been perverted and abused by sinners. It can be a huge time waster. 55% of teens have a social networking page, and over half of them check their page more than once a day. Almost a quarter, 22%, check more than 10 times a day. And teachers are often victims of mockery or criticism on pupils' pages. And there's also the problem of inappropriate sharing of personal information and photos. 28% have shared personal information about themselves they would not normally share in public. 22% have posted naked or semi-naked photos or videos of themselves or others online. So, let's see how we can apply our seven-step training program for Facebook. Step one is educate. You need to get a Facebook page yourself and understand how it all works. Especially, keep abreast of the privacy settings, which Facebook seems to change frequently. Then, teach your children that they are leaving a public and permanent digital footprint with everything they post. It's not like writing a private diary or a journal. And even if you or they later take down the photos or posts, others can have copied them and passed them on. This can have severe consequences for future relationships and even job prospects, as many employers will now automatically Google or Facebook all job applicants before deciding whom to interview. Step 2, fence. It's vital to set time limits on Facebook. Limit the number of times and length of time you allow your children to be on Facebook. I'd suggest no more than 15 to 30 minutes a day in one sitting. And it's amazing what can be squeezed into 30 minutes when a time limit is set. Also set boundaries on what content your children are allowed to post, both in terms of writing and photos. No revealing photos, no photos of other members of the family, so on. In fact, if you want to use Facebook for family communications, I would suggest that you have a separate Facebook account that's kept just for that. Don't allow criticism to be posted of family members, friends, or teachers. Set boundaries also on what friends they are allowed on Facebook. You shouldn't allow them to friend anyone on Facebook that they would not usually have as a normal friend. Take also control of their passwords so that they cannot get on without you signing them in. Step 3, mentor. In the early stages of Facebooking, you should sit with your kids and guide them as they update their status, request friends, respond to friend requests and comment on other friends and so on. Step 4, supervise. As you grow more confident in your children's maturity and understanding, then you can move towards supervision. Physical supervision means that their screens are visible as they Facebook. Digital supervision means that you are one of their friends, allowing you to see their updates and interactions with others. Step 5, review. Every week or so, you should review their pages with them. Highlight the good, point out any mistakes they might have made, and encourage them to reflect before they reveal. Teach them the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and the silicon rule, don't say anything to anyone in the digital world that you would not say to their face in the real world. Remind them that you have the right to unfriend anyone you decide is inappropriate, and if they've transgressed, point them to Christ for forgiveness and cleansing. Step 6, trust. Over time, your children will hopefully adopt your guidance, see the wisdom of your instruction, and respond to any sanctions. And as you feel you can trust them more, you can increasingly replace the weekly review with more irregular and sporadic review, until eventually no reviews will be necessary. I'd still recommend that you remain a friend for as long as you deem necessary. For example, I have my wife as one of my friends on Facebook. Step 7, model. As with all digital technology, you should model good Facebook conduct to your children. Let them see how you use Facebook, how you use it positively for social, business, and gospel opportunities. And show them that making face-to-face friendship is the priority. Lastly, and above all, remind them that they must maintain a spiritual relationship with the Lord. So, let's wrap up. We've examined 4 fundamental biblical principles. We've seen there are 3 ways to respond to technology, and we've proposed a 7-step training program and shown how that works out in the case of Facebook. Ultimately, however, we must pray for our children to have new hearts in order to rightly handle the new technology. Our children, sadly, are born with sinful and depraved hearts. They will therefore love darkness rather than light. They are going to be attracted to the dark side of the internet. So, we must pray for them. Pray for them to be born again. We must pray that God would replace the love of darkness with love for the light. Only then will they turn their backs on evil communications which corrupt good manners. Only then will they want to think on whatsoever things are good, true, and of good report. We can train, legislate, hover, but above all, we must pray that our children would ultimately live and obey not out of fear of the law, but out of love for Christ. Then they will pray more than Twitter. They will seek the face of Christ in the Book of Books, and they will fill their space with the one who fills all space.
Recommend those of you who use the internet. That's a very good page, the headhearthands.org page that David's put together, Dr. Murray. So, in a little bit of time we have before lunch, I don't want to limit our discussion to just Facebook, although we can talk about that certainly. But concerns, questions, tips, observations about internet use in general. What's on your mind? Michael. Good point. I think for me, and this didn't start with the internet, it actually started with medical advances, so-called medical advances. The way typically things work in our society, it's invented first, it's promoted first, and then we think about the consequences. And a lot of us, because something works, or because something is neat, or something has potential, we tend to take it on without really thinking it through. Like, how many of us sitting here remember the world before cell phones, the world before the computer, the world before internet? Well, that world was just a few years ago. I mean, if you think about, you know, the PC has only been available publicly since the middle 70s. And those computers, unless you really knew DOS and other fancy things like that, you didn't have a clue what to do with them anyway, because there were no programs until Windows came out to speak of, except the kind of programs you have to program. Cell phones, how many years have we had cell phones? Not very long. I can remember when the calculator came out. Hey, young people got a chuckle. I was in college when the first handheld calculator, it cost $100. You could pick them up for a couple bucks and a half. In the first ones, I remember the Hewlett-Packard one, you had to use what they called reverse Polish notation. You know, you didn't do 6 times 6 equals, you did 6, enter 6 times. And I remember spending about one third of my precious time on my first examination in pharmacy school trying to figure out how the stupid thing worked, because I couldn't get it to do what I wanted it to do. But my point is, for you young folks, you can hardly imagine a world without cell phones, computers, and this and that and the other thing. That world does exist. It did exist. And we did all right. So I'm not saying we don't have to do any of this stuff or we shouldn't do any of this stuff, but I am saying, before you take something on just because it's there, think. Do I need this? Is it going to bring more temptation into my life than benefit? Is it going to reduce my actual time interacting with people in a one-to-one, face-to-face, ear-to-speaker situation? Is this really good for me? Now, I know young people pretty well, you know, having 8 children and now 3 grandchildren. It's easy to justify everything by pointing to, well, it has this potential good. I mean, we all can do that. But that's not the point. You know, practically everything has some potential good, but the question is, at what price? How much time? You know, there was a study put out a while ago that just the technology that makes screens show what they do is changing the way our brains are forming. You know, the old cathode ray tubes that used to be the basis of TVs and the old big old computer monitors, now replaced by LCDs, they had an electron gun that went up and down, or I should say side to side and down the screen and reset. And the refresh rate, for those who know what that is, was like in the tens of thousands of scans per second. Well, we only see a picture on a screen, but what we're not seeing are all those electrons flying back and forth and up and down that screen many, many times a second, which, without our realizing, is influencing the way our neurons in our minds are transmitting information to each other. And there's some speculation that the reduced ability to concentrate today has everything to do with the fact that we process information digitally and electronically more than we do, like, reading words on pages. So it isn't just the content. It's the very means by which the content is sent out. We have no idea today the effect of cell phone waves, radio waves, microwaves, and who knows what electromagnetic waves that are generated simply by electricity passing through wires, magnetic waves. All these waves are passing through our system regularly without our consent, necessarily. You know, you hear about the studies once in a while, you know, cell phone use, there might be a link between that and tumors or whatever. That's the tip of the iceberg. There's tons of stuff being generated across the airwaves that we don't see, we don't know about, that we're being affected by. So, my plea is, let's not just use stuff because it's there and because we can see some potential good. I personally think that a lot of this stuff is degrading our ability to meaningfully have relationships with each other. Electronic relationships are not the same as interpersonal relationships among people. And if we're going to spend a disproportionately large amount of time communicating with people electronically, that leaves us all the less time to communicate with God and with each other personally. And time use is one of the hugest concerns I have. You might use all of this technology really well for very good purposes, but how long would we spend that amount of time on a phone? Would we spend that amount of time traveling to talk to somebody in person? Probably not. But because it's so easy to do it, we get sucked in, and then we're there for minutes and then hours. I remember when I was a deacon, this goes back 20 years, we used to count money we used to rotate the deacons' homes where we counted the money. And I remember computer games were just coming out then. We sat down for our meeting, and in the corner of my eye, I watched the deacon's son playing a computer game. We had some business to discuss and other things. It was probably 3 hours later that kid hadn't moved. And I'm thinking, okay, that's just what I saw. He was there when I came in. He was there when I left. He barely said hello. Now, picture an entire family all facing their own personal screen.
something's not working. We're interacting with a lot of people, but none of them happen to be in the same house. So, just a little commentary on social networking. Other thoughts that you can share that may help put things in perspective. Experiences you've had that taught you something. Don't be shy now. You have been such an interactive thing. The Petersons from Texas are going to think you people are just all receptors. We just finished a 10 session study on Christian courtship. You should have heard the contributions by these people. So come on. So, they want to come back here. They want to maybe move here. Mr. Selby.
I'd just like to comment on my experience with Facebook. It took me quite a while to be able to get on Facebook because of all this stuff. I was finally persuaded and have decided to use it as a mission outreach. Okay. I try to put up a Bible verse and a thought frequently. And I'm getting more and more friends to follow that and are blessed by that.
Friends.
Yeah, well, they're friends that I've known in childhood that
okay.
I might not talk about otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it can be a wonderful outreach. I know it can also be a time waster. And I set very strict limits as to how much time I spend on it. I think the suggestions are excellent. It's also a window into souls that you haven't heard before. You can look at a young person's page and just in a couple of seconds you can see where their heart is.
And that is, let me just interact with a couple of things you said. One, I think one of our daughters just said today or yesterday that people are in touch with her that she grew up with years ago in a different state, in a different school, lost total track of, and now is reconnecting. So there is that. But we also talked about the sidebar. You know, you saw what an enormous amount of economics is happening, business is happening on these pages. They're not free. Somebody's paying the bill. Well, you can't control those. So,
On Firefox, there's an ad block that you can...
But isn't that just for pop-ups, or is that all ads?
It's
Linux. No, I know what you're saying, Firefox, but what I'm asking is, does it block just pop-ups or all ads?
It blocks any particular ad that you click on, but it won't block... You have to block it yourself. But if you get on the page again, it'll...
Right, but what I'm saying is, you know, and I'm not as familiar with Facebook as maybe I could be, but isn't it true when you bring up Facebook or when you bring up YouTube or anything else, there's a lot of content on the page you can't control.
Yeah.
At least initially. It's there, and then you can maybe do something with it, but it's there. That's a danger. You have no control over that. That was actually one of my biggest issues with television many years ago. When I sit down with young couples preparing them for marriage, we talk a little bit about technology. We talk about visual technology. We talk about the differences between DVDs, used to be VCRs, DVDs, internet, television. And most are like, they all lump it in the same bucket. They're not in the same bucket. Now, there are such things as TiVo and whatnot that you can kind of cut out commercials and stuff. But one of the biggest things was you couldn't control the spontaneity. Stuff comes up, you have no, maybe it's a program you've watched for years, you thought was decent, all of a sudden the writer of that particular episode had some crazy idea, threw in something really awful, there you are. And you can't erase that. It's there. Well, you can, but it's there. You saw it, now you're moving away from it, you're reacting to it, but it was there. You saw it. DVDs, a little more control, you know what you're renting, maybe it's been reviewed by people you trust, so a little bit more awareness coming up front. Internet, can you really control everything you see? Maybe you have a trusted news source, but are there advertisements on that news page? Are there entertainment things that you don't want to see? You don't want to see? So, a plea for spontaneity, be careful. About what can appear and what that can do to you without you even wanting to see it.
I think another observation I make about the internet, and I use it a lot for some research and whatnot. I don't know how many of you have ever been to the Library of Congress. That is a magnificent place. Many books there. There's more information on the internet right now than that. But the thing I would comment about, it even showed up in what we
Right.
How worthwhile were those opinions?
Right.
If you think about the fact that these people can get a wild hair or some night, sit up for 2 hours and write something that people all over the world are reading, when you go to the Library of Congress, for instance, you're reading stuff that people had to pay to get them into.
Mm-hmm. Register.
Mm-hmm. There was a certain amount of more pure oversight, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. And now we're looking at a very individual, a mass of information, good and bad.
And the fact is, for those of you who are somewhat tech savvy in the coding department, there are ways to get what you write bumped up to the first page of Google. People pay enormous amounts of money to very sophisticated firms to make sure when somebody Googles something, your page hits the front page. Because who's going to go to page 52? Not many of us do that. But that's where you end up if you don't have somebody who knows what they're doing getting you on page 1 of Google, which is pretty much where people stop. Now, when we were researching the Lord's Supper frequency issue, there was a lot of scholarly sounding stuff. Citations of scripture, explanations, Greek words. It looked impressive until you actually knew what they were saying. And if you had some familiarity with the principles and the texts and the context of the text, so it's like, this is baloney. But any unsuspecting person, Google this, oh wow. And I think like the first 10, 15 entries, most of them came down on one side of an issue. I think there was one or two exceptions talking about the yearly, and that was even a sidetrack in a different direction, which wasn't very helpful. It took a lot of digging to find anything that really got to the meat and potatoes of the argument. Well, most people don't have the patience for that or the discernment. So be careful how you read what you read. It can sound great, but who knows who these people are?
And so I would encourage, based on that, to not just read two-page articles on the internet on an issue. Get the systematic theology of some trusted. And I'm not saying that they are right, but there was more thought put into that.
What I would suggest is ask people for resources. Now, I'm not advertising my assistance, because if you ask me what's a good book on or where can I go for, I'm glad to help you there. But I want you to do your own work. I want you to read the thing. I want you to study. I want you to think. I don't want to digest it for you. But I'd be more than happy, and I think our elders would, and other mature Christians, hey, I'm looking for something on. I get those questions all the time. Those are good questions, because maybe somebody has found some really helpful resources. And that's where the body of Christ comes in. That's why forums like this are helpful. What have you found about this stuff that can help other people who haven't thought of it? Which brings me back to the open floor. Any other contributions to this discussion? Scott?
What limited stuff we've seen dug up on, you know, websites, not so much, well, downstream, not so much on websites, but maybe direct blogs, is that shallow.
Mm.
The information that's there, you almost have to, you know, I've said it with my kids, that who has time to put this information on a blog that you update and you update and you update? Is it the guy who's actually out there doing it? Or is it the guy out there theorizing on how to do it?
Mm.
I mean, I work in carpentry, I work in mechanics. And, you know, I look at, every once in a while, search out some procedure. And you read through it, and you say, this guy's never seen a car. He don't know anything about building. He's just throwing an idea out there, and he happens to be good at the web.
Right.
So he gets read a lot, and he's up on the top. And so now, you know, without the base knowledge of the subject,
mm-hmm.
if somebody else goes on there and says, how do I build a fence or how do I repair a radiator, they just take this guy and, well, he's on the first page of Google.
Mm. And
apparently he knows.
And there's a lot more people advertising than you think. You think you're reading an article about how to do this, but the guy is really getting you to a product, to a service, without even looking like it. It used to be, there were the advertisements, there's the pros, now it's like, what's an advertisement? What's reality? What's a guy helping you for free? You know, how many times have you looked for a program? Just yesterday, I'm looking for a program to edit PDF files without paying Adobe like $500 for their professional thing. Free, you know, none of them. It's like you click on, okay, you get a 10-day demonstration thing and then you got to pay. It's like, it gets so frustrating. Well, that's true with a lot of stuff. It looks like this and you get there and it's not. It's a great point. John?
I think that was it's on there with saying, instead of us going looking for the product's going to come and find us.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to find a way.
Have you noticed lately? I just remarked about this the other day. I was looking for a log splitter. I have since purchased one. Everywhere I go, I'm finding advertisements on my screen for log splitters. It's like, it must be the season. You know, that's scary. I mean, I'm finding the same company promoting the same splitters on Drudge Report, on other pages. It's like, how they know? Well, they know. They keep track of where you go and what you're interested in, and they kind of throw the... That's the next level of advertisement, Scott.
One thing I did notice, too, if you're looking at comparable websites on the product that we sell, and we found that there was scam, you know, beware of this. You know, so you sit there and you go, okay, what's the other site saying? Realize that it was an advertisement for the product.
Right.
You can't even get a negative view on the product without
advertising. Yeah.
It's changed so fast. I talked to a marketing engineer who I was trying to, you know, get off page 52 to page number one.
Yeah.
And she says it's not like it was 5 years ago.
No.
She says it's a whole new world out there.
My daughter brought me her calculator to find sines and cosines. I couldn't get the answer in the book for nothing. I pushed all the buttons that looked like the right ones. And did you ever figure that out, by the way, Beth? How to do sine and cosine? Is just Esther straighten you out on that?
One.
I just point him to my other children. I don't even bother anymore. John, or I think Josh, you had something, right?
I guess the two main principles to learn myself and also especially for my children would be the principle of redeeming the time. Because especially with children, it's like they don't think in terms of how fast their time can just be completely wasted.
Hmm.
But especially in terms of social networking, there is a fear for me as far as you don't even have to leave your house to have friends in.
Hmm.
I mean, that's, and it really is, if you look at some of the studies, it really is affecting especially young people. Just recently, you know, I can't remember how long ago it was, but the girl ends up killing herself because some of the pictures that were posted of her on and exchanged through her cell phone. But there are some good books out there that that you can look at in terms of like how we are being dumbed down, essentially.
Can you think of them offhand?
The use of the internet. I think of one is called How Is Google Dumbing Down America?
Hmm.
I think. I can't remember the author. And then there's others out there, but social networking is, if we don't guard our children, it really makes them susceptible.
Do you guys remember the lessons, I'm talking to the older folks, the lessons in English class, how to use a card catalog in the library, how to look up words in a dictionary. Who picks up a dictionary anymore?
How many in here have seen this library?
Oh, now wait a minute. Now you're pushing the envelope. A slide rule?
Yeah.
That was before calculators.
Yeah.
All the engineering students, us pharmacy students, didn't bother with that.
Originally,
Jones.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Our professor in chemistry refused to allow us to use calculators. He said, "You are doing this the way we used to do it, longhand. I want to make sure your brains still work." So we'd spend hours crunching enormous equations. And we're like, "Oh, this is Scott."
We were looking up amortizations. The bank amortization.
Oh, got it. Right. Yep. Right.
He said, "Well, surely you have a formula, because there's actually
right.
a formula for it on the internet. So
right.
I went out there and they could tell me the answer I want to know, but they could come with a formula."
Right.
So I said, "Well, I'll do the old school method and call up the banks." I said, "What's the formula for the MRI?"
I know what happened.
She said, "Well, how much do you need?"
Just a second.
You know, I was taught that. It's just, I've never used it.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So, how much of this stuff eventually are these, the younger generation?
Okay, here's the question of all questions. How many have heard of EMP weapons? Okay. EMP weapons, electromagnetic pulse. One of those launched from a ship offshore, could be a barge or whatever, a single nuclear weapon placed at the right place above our country, exploded at the right height, could eliminate every electronic circuit we have. Now, if you think about that, refrigeration, communication, every single car that has a computer in it, you just start thinking that through, we are back in the 1800s. And you know what? We have so become dependent. There's going to be mass starvation. There's going to be chaos. There's going to be people just going wild. I mean, picture New York City. You can't get out of New York City without crossing a bridge. Okay, all cars stop in place. All refrigeration is over. You can't get food from California anymore. There's no trucks to bring it, no trains to bring it, no planes to fly it, no refrigeration to keep it. So whatever food you have on hand is all you have for like 9, 10, 30 million people in a small area. One weapon. And we, to my knowledge, have no defense against it. Sylvia?
I didn't finish my comment. I want to go on.
Please.
I agree with what this man is saying. We need to be extremely careful. And I would be extremely careful. I would not let young children on the internet. And I would wait until they were very mature and they could use it for a good tool. You know, the more potential something has for good, also the more potential for evil.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that we need to live in such a way that we aren't dependent on this technology.
Right.
And that we keep staying tuned with the people around us.
Thank you. My oldest son is in Wall Street. He works for Goldman Sachs. He asked me a while ago, what do you recommend for an investment? You know what I told him? Land. A piece of land you can grow something on. Because, you know, and I appreciate, like, some of you are into precious metals and stuff. If we get in dire trouble, you can't eat gold. The only thing that's going to be worth anything is food and land. And, you know, so some of you folks who are, you know, trying to set yourself up to be semi-independent or totally independent of the system, that's not a dumb idea these days. Because if serious things begin to happen, now the only downside is everybody's going to know who's got the food. Because you've been not shopping at the stores very much. And, oh, that guy out there, he's got everything. So expect the whole of the city folk to be visiting your farm or whatever. I know. There's ways of helping yourself out there. We better quit. I saw the young people coming in already, so they are done. Alan, last comment.
I think it also goes along with your sermon this morning, because I think people use it too much as a way of escaping if it's on Facebook or any of those things. It's not just a way to communicate with friends. It's a way to zone out and go in their own little cyber world and not have to deal with reality.
Yes.
And if it's serving the internet for information or whatever that may be, there's a lot of ways that they can do it.
Yeah. Very true. Okay, let's...
I used to do that just reading books and stuff.
cleanse his own out.
We can continue our conversation when we have lunch. Let's pray together.